Weak, she insisted. I talked to Chago about it once, and he told me it started when Raymond was just a little kid. He'd blink his eyes, and then the twitches started, and pretty soon he was barking and coughing. His father figured he was doing it on purpose, just to get attention, so he used to beat him up. He did some other stuff, too, which got him thrown into prison. Poor Raymond. He was hyperactive in school, in trouble all the time. It's probably why his mother left. And he's done it ever since? The whole time you've known him? He got better for a while, but then it started up again, worse than before. Can't the doctors do anything? What doctors? He doesn't see doctors. Sometimes sex calms him down. Booze or sleep, dope. Once he got the flu and had a fever, 103, he was fine, no problem, never even had a twitch. He was great for 2 days. Flu went away, he was at it again, this time licking his lips, doing this weird thing with his hands. I don't want to talk about it anymore. It's depressing. Raymond returned just before lunch with a folded newspaper and a bag of donuts. Louise and the dog came in right behind him. If Raymond was in mourning for his brother, I saw no signs of it. The ticking seemed less evident today, but I couldn't be sure. He left the room at intervals, and I began to suspect he was venting in the other room. That or shooting up. I was just getting into a really trashy soap, my bare legs thrown over the arm of the chair, sandal flapping on one foot, when he and Louise sat down at the kitchen table, talking softly in Spanish. During the next commercial, I went into the kitchen and got myself a glass of water. I paused, peering over Raymond's shoulder to see what they were up to. It was pure nosiness on my part, but he didn't seem to mind. What I'd thought was the daily paper turned out to be a throwaway rag filled with classifieds. Louise flipped to the automobile section and folded back the pages. I checked the dateline. Thursday, October 27th. These were probably new listings for the weekend coming up. Louise skipped over the trucks, vans, and imports and concentrated on the domestic cars for sale. "Here's one," Louise said. With a magic marker, he circled an ad for a 1979 Caddy. I leaned closer, reading, "Good condition. $999. O.B.O. "What's O.B.O.?" I asked. I knew, but I wanted to demonstrate some interest, and I thought showing ignorance was the safest bet.
"Or best offer," Raymond said. "You want a Cadillac?"
"Who, me? Not especially."
"I like that Chrysler Cordoba," Raymond said to
Luis, pointing to the next box. Louise drew a wobbly-sided egg around the ad for a 77 white, runs, looks great, $895 OBO. A telephone number was listed on both ads. Raymond got up and left the room, returning with the telephone, which he plugged into the wall jack. I pulled up a chair and sat down. Louise continued to circle ads while Raymond placed call after call, inquiring about each car that interested them, making note of the address. When this exercise was complete and they'd culled out the ads of interest, Luis made a list on a separate piece of paper. Raymond glanced at me.
"You have car insurance?"
"Sure."
"What kind?"
I shrugged. "Whatever the state of California requires. I've been thinking I should drop it since my car's dead."
"Why?" "You have liability and collision?"
"How do I know? I don't walk around with the details of my car insurance memorized. The policy's up in Santa Teresa."
"Can't your insurance company give you the information?"
"Sure, if they looked it up."
"Might be worth it to get your car fixed if you got collision coverage."
Raymond lifted the telephone receiver and held it out to me.
"Call 'em."
"Right now?"
"Is that a problem?"
"Not at all," I said with an uneasy laugh. I could feel my heart start to bang in my chest. The thumping felt so conspicuous I checked to see if my T-shirt was pulsating in the front. For a moment, my mind went blank. I couldn't remember California Fidelity's number. I couldn't remember the contact number Dolan had given me, and I couldn't decide which to try in any event. I took the receiver. I punched in the 805 area code, hoping for the best. Automatically, my fingers moved across the face of the telephone, dialing CF in a medley of musical tones that sounded like Mary Had a Little Lamb.
I wondered if Dolan had been in touch with Mac Voorhees. Was I going to have my cover blown right here on the spot? The number rang twice. Darcy answered. I hoped I didn't sound like myself when I said, "May I speak to Mr. Voorhees?" "Just a moment, please. I'll ring his office." She clicked off. Music played in the background, filling telephone limbo with an orchestrated rendition of How High the Moon. Inexplicably, the lyrics popped into my head unbidden. I thought about Donna, wondering how long the cops could hold her. Wounded or not, she was dangerous. Chapter 15. Mac came on the line.
Voorhees.
Mr. Voorhees, my name is Hannah Moore. I have car insurance with your company, and I wanted to check on my coverage. There was dead silence. I knew he recognized my voice. Raymond leaned his head close to mine, angling the phone so he could listen to the conversation. Mac hesitated. I could hear him grope with the request, trying to figure out what was going on and what he could say without jeopardizing my situation, whatever that might be. He knew me well enough to realize I wouldn't make such a call without a good reason.
"Is this regarding an automobile accident?"
he asked cautiously. "Well, no. I might be driving a friend's car, and he doesn't like the idea unless he knows I'm covered." Raymond's face was 6 inches away from mine. I could smell his aftershave and feel the warm, slightly adenoidal character of his breath.
"I can understand that. Is your friend there now?" Mac asked.
"That's right."
"Do you have the policy number handy?"
No. But the agent is Con Dolan." Raymond drew back and reached for a piece of paper, scratching out a note. "Ask about collision." I hate it when people coach me when I'm on the phone. He pointed significantly. I waved at him with irritation. It's really the collision I need to know about," I amended. Another awkward pause. I smiled at Raymond wanly while Mac cleared his throat.
"I tell you what I'll do, Miss
Moore."
"Yes, all right. Why don't I see if I can get in touch with Mr. Dolan? He's no longer with the company, but I'm sure he's still in town. I can check our files for the coverage and get back to you. Is there a number where you can be reached this afternoon?"
Raymond pulled his head back and put a finger to his lips. I said, "Not really. I'm staying with this guy in Los Angeles, and I'm not sure how long I'll be here. I could call again later if you'll tell me what time."
"Try 5 this afternoon. I should have the information by then."
"Thanks. I'd appreciate it." I handed Raymond the receiver, and he hung it up.
"What did he say?"
"He's going to check. I'm supposed to call him back this afternoon at 5.
"But as far as you know, the insurance is in effect."
"I told you it was." Raymond and Luis exchanged a look. Raymond looked over his shoulder at Bibiana, still intent on her game of solitaire.
"Get your jacket. We're going out."
And then to me,
"You need a jacket? She'll give you one."
"What's happening?"
"We're going on a drive down."
"Whatever that is," I said. We took Sepulveda Boulevard up to Culver City with Luis at the wheel. Bibiana was being sullen, sitting silently in the back seat with her arms crossed, while Raymond either made calls on the car phone or rubbed, petted, and generally annoyed her, rambling on about all the money he meant to make, all the things he'd done, and all the big plans he had for the two of them. I had to give that guy some lessons. He was going about this all wrong. Aside from the fact that, unknown to him, she was already Mrs. Jimmy Tate, she was never going to tumble to all the smoke he was blowing. Women don't want to sit around listening to guys talk about themselves. Women like to have conversations about real things, like feelings, namely theirs. Raymond seemed to think he just hadn't persuaded her yet of the depth of his affection. I wanted to scream, "She knows that, you dummy! She just doesn't give a shit!" We pulled up at the first address. The 79 Caddy was parked at the curb, a black Seville, being offered by a muscular black guy with a pink shower cap,
a tattooed teardrop on his cheek, and a gold hoop through his left ear. Honestly, I'm not making this stuff up. He wore a T-shirt and low-slung jeans, with his Calvin Klein sticking out above his belt. He was actually very cute, with a mustache and goatee, a mischievous smile, and a little space between his teeth. Bibiana stayed in the car, but I got out and stood around with the guys, shifting from foot to foot while the three of them entered into a long and tedious negotiation. Raymond went through several sequences of ticking, but the black guy didn't react except to stop making eye contact. I could see that in some circles, Raymond would be treated like a walking basket case. I wanted to speak up protectively and say, "Hey, the guy can't help it, okay?" The OBO turned out to be $100 less than the $999 listed in the paper. Raymond turned his body slightly and took out a fat cylinder of bills with a rubber band wrapped around them. He slipped the rubber band over his wrist while he peeled off the right denominations. The pink slip was signed and changed hands, but I couldn't believe Raymond was actually going to take it down to the DMV. Habitual criminals never seem to be troubled about things like that. They do anything they please, while the rest of us feel compelled to play by the rules. The black guy strolled off as soon as the transaction was completed. Raymond and Louise made a study of the car, which seemed to be in reasonable shape. Chrome flakes were peeling off the bumper, and the right rear tailgate had been smashed. The tires were bald, but the body didn't show any major dents. The interior was gray, a rip in the passenger seat neatly sutured with black thread. The floor, front and back, was littered with fast food containers, empty soft drink cans, crushed cigarette packs, newspapers. Louise took a few minutes to shove it all into the gutter, emptying the ashtray in a little mountain of cigarette butts.
"What do you think?" Raymond asked me.
I couldn't imagine why my opinion mattered. "Looks better than anything I ever drove." He stuck a finger in the key ring and flipped the keys into his palm.
"Hop in. Bibiana goes with him."
I glanced over at the dark green Ford where Bibiana sat. She was perched up on the back seat, using the rearview mirror to braid her dark, glossy hair.
"Fine with me," I said.
I got into the caddy. Raymond got in on the driver's side and slipped his seatbelt on.
"Buckle up," he said. "We're going to have an accident."
"Is this car insured? We just bought the damn thing," I said with surprise.
"Don't worry about that stuff. I can call my agent later. He does anything I want."
I buckled up, trying to picture myself in a neck brace. The transmission was automatic. The car had power locks and power brakes, power windows. Raymond started the engine, which thrummed to life. He adjusted the rearview mirror and waited while a silver Toyota passed at cruising speed before he pulled into the lane of traffic. I tried the power windows, which went up with a quiet hum.
"How do we do this?" I asked. "You'll see."
We seemed to drive randomly, taking Venice Boulevard through Palms, turning right on Sepulveda, into an area called Mar Vista. These were neighborhoods of small stucco bungalows with small yards and tired trees with leaves that were oxygen-starved from all the smog in the air. Raymond watched the streets like a cop looking for the telltale indications of a crime in progress. "What makes this a drive-down?"
"That's just what we call it when we are out cruising for an accident. Car's called a bucket. I got a fleet of buckets, a whole crew of drivers doing just what we're doing. You're a ghost."
I smiled. "Why's that?"
"Because you don't get paid, therefore you don't exist."
"How come I don't get paid?"
"You're a trainee. You're just here to beef up the headcount."
"Oh, thanks," I said. I turned and looked out the window on the passenger side.
"So, what are we looking for?"
Raymond glanced at me sharply, suspicion etched in his face.
"I'm just trying to learn," I said.
"A victim. We call 'em Vicks," he replied in belated answer to my question. "Somebody running a stop sign, backing out of a drive into the right-of-way, pulling out of a parking space."
"And then what?"
He smiled to himself. "We hit the guy. You want to catch the rear quarter panel because the damage shows up nice and nobody gets hurt."
We drove around for an hour, unable to conjure up a traffic offender for the life of us. I could see that Raymond was impatient, but oddly enough, there was no twitching whatever during the time in the car. Maybe work was soothing to his battered nervous system. "Let me try," I said.
"You serious?"
"If I score, I want the money. What's it pay?"
$100 a day.
"You're full of shit. I bet you make a fortune, and I want a fair shake."
"Pushy bitch," he said mildly.
We traded places. I took a moment to slide the front seat a little closer to the gas pedal and the brake. I eased the caddy into traffic. By then, we'd worked our way up Lincoln Boulevard to the outskirts of Santa Monica. At Pico, I cut left, picking up Ocean Avenue at San Vicente. Raymond hadn't paid much attention, but when he saw the direction I was taking, he looked at me with surprise.
"What's wrong with Venice?"
"Why not Beverly Hills?" I asked. At first, the idea seemed to unsettle him, but he could see the possibilities. We worked our way up to Sunset Boulevard and headed east, passing the northern perimeter of the sprawling UCLA campus. Just past the Beverly Hills Hotel, I took a right onto Rexford. I found it soothing to cruise along the wide, tree-lined streets. This was an area known as the Flats of Beverly Hills. The houses were oversized and filled the lots from side to side. All the lawns were green, the shrubs trimmed, gardeners blowing errant leaves down the driveways. Shade trees were planted along the grassy stretch between sidewalk and street, sycamores interspersed with oaks. High fences shielded the backyard tennis courts from sight. Now and then I caught a glimpse of a swimming pool and cabana. The stoplight at Santa Monica Boulevard was green. I drove the caddy sedately into the heart of the Beverly Hills shopping district. Technically, I knew I was skating on thin ice with this drive down. The only thing I remembered about undercover work from police academy days is that it's against public policy for an officer of the law to participate in the commission of a crime or incite someone to do so. Happily, I wasn't actually an officer of the law, and if it ever came right down to it, it would be Raymond's word against mine. Helping Raymond stage a few fraudulent accidents seemed to me the quickest way to persuade him I was on the up and up. Raymond stared out the window, his manner uneasy.
"You're never going to find any business up here."
"Want a bet?" I had just spotted a late-model Mercedes pulling out of a parking lot in the middle of the block, left turn signal blinking. The car was a four-door sedan, a conservative black with a vanity plate that read, "Bull Market." Bull, MKT. The woman driving was probably 40 years old, with a cap of blonde hair and big round sunglasses pulled down toward the tip of her nose. I slowed the caddy, mentally apologizing for my sins in advance. I came to a full stop and politely waved her out. She gave me a quick wave and a smile, showing perfect caps.
"What are you doing?"
"Yielding the right-of-way," I said with innocence. As soon as the Mercedes eased into my path, I gunned the caddy and rammed the left rear quadrant with a thump. It was just like bumper cars, and I felt the same sick charge, half guilt, half thrill. The indentation was nicely placed. The woman shrieked and turned to look at me open-mouthed with astonishment. Raymond was out of the caddy in a flash.
"What the fuck are you doing? You pulled out right in front of us."
I got out and moved to the front of the caddy, where I checked the broken headlight and flaking bumper. Not bad. The damage to the other car was $6,000 at least. The blonde had recovered from her initial dismay. She got out of the Mercedes and slammed the car door. She was dressed for tennis. Little white skirt, green and white striped polo shirt, long tan legs, little socks with jaunty green pom-poms sticking out above her spotless white tennis shoes. The Mercedes's left rear quadrant, recently a pristine shiny black, now sported a dent of substantial proportions. Fender crumpled, chrome sticking out like a horizontal antenna. The rear door would have to be pried open with a crowbar. I could see the color rising in her face as she surveyed the damage. She turned and jabbed an angry finger in my face. "You fucking asshole! You sat there and motioned me out!"
"She did not," Raymond said.
"She did, too!" "Did not," I inserted to show where my loyalties lay. Raymond said,
"Look at my car. We just bought this car, and now look what you've done."
"Your car? Look at mine!" I put a hand against my neck, and Raymond turned to me with concern.
Are you okay, hon?
I guess so, I said without conviction. The neck roll I did was accompanied by a wince. Raymond dropped his irate manner and substituted an air of studied calm that was more effective in its way.
Lady, I hope you got good insurance coverage.
The afternoon was marked by Raymond's intermittent demolition derby, surreal in its fashion, depressing in its effect. We backtracked from Beverly Hills into Brentwood, through Westwood, and then south into Santa Monica again. We sought out areas congested with traffic, watched for minor violations, inattentiveness, and lapses in judgment. Raymond kept a meticulous record of each accident we staged, four in all, noting time and location, the other driver's name, and insurance company. The caddy performed like a first-rate battering ram, sustaining very little damage for the losses we inflicted on other unsuspecting motorists. The victim seemed so gullible somehow, distressed, apologetic, sometimes irate, but usually worried they'd be slapped with ruinous lawsuits. I played my part, righteous and upset, pretending sudden shooting pains in my neck or back. But I couldn't bear to look at them. This was not a kind of cheating I did very well, and I could proceed only by employing the same mental detachment I adopt when I enter a morgue. Raymond, of course, was only interested in filing phony claims for vehicular damage, and whatever injuries we could fake as a consequence. His skills at manipulation were honed by long practice. At four, much to my relief, he decided we'd done enough. I'd been at the wheel for the first couple of accidents, then Raymond had taken over. He found an on-ramp for the 405 and headed south toward the apartment. I felt like a traveling salesperson on the road with my boss. My questions to Raymond had the same banal thrust you'd imagine from a Fuller Brush trainee. "What's your background for this?" said I, much as if I were inquiring about his qualifications for a career with Encyclopedia Britannica.
"Some guy taught me the business when I was first starting out. He's in the slammer, so it's my operation."
"Like a promotion?"
"Yeah, right, exactly. I got a stable of doctors and attorneys who do the actual paperwork. I'm strictly supervision. Times are slow, I do a little work like this. I like to keep a hand in."
"Your job is what, supplying the claimants?"
"Well, yeah. What do you think we've been doing all afternoon? Right now I got a crew of 10, but that goes up and down. It's hard to get good help."
I laughed. "I bet."
"I'll tell you a little secret. And this is the key to sound business management. Be careful of the guy right below you on the pyramid. You don't tell him jack shit."
"Because he might want to take over?"
"That's right. He's the dude wants to put a knife in your back. You take Luis. I love the guy like a brother. But certain things I don't tell him. People he doesn't see. That way, I don't have to worry. Know what I mean?"
"The money must be good." Raymond shook his head.
"Are you kidding? The money's great. I make maybe $1,000 a case, depending on the nature of the injury. The GP or the chiropractor probably clears another $1,500.
"God, that's amazing. What do? Pad the fees?"
"Sometimes they do. Or they charge for services never rendered. The insurance company doesn't know the difference, and either way, the doc makes out. Plus, you have the attorney on top of that," he said.
He smiled wryly.
"Of course, the biggest chunk goes to me."
"Because you take all the risks?"
"Because I put up all the dough. Bankroll the cars, pay all the cappers up front. I probably shell out $5,000 or $6,000 per crew to get 'em rolling. Multiply that by 10, 20 crews working 7 days a week. It adds up."
"Sounds like it," I said, and let the subject drop. A long silence followed. I still didn't have a fix on the mental arithmetic, but the money was clearly huge. I laid my head back against the seat. It wasn't hard to see the appeal. For a guy like Raymond, the money was a lot better than an honest day's work. Hell, I could make more money crashing cars than I did as a PI. Of course, there was a downside. With all the bumps, smacks, and minor episodes of whiplash, My head was pounding and my neck was seizing up. I massaged the muscles along one shoulder, feeling tense.
What's the matter?
My neck's stiff.
You and me both,
he said in a moment of self-mockery. He looked at me closely.
For real?
Raymond, we've just been in 4 auto accidents. That last one we had, I nearly slid off the seat. You could have warned me.
You want to see a doctor? I can set it up. Heat treatments, ultrasound, anything you want. It's one of the perks.
Let me see how I feel when we get back to the apartment. Where's Bibiana? I hope I'm not the only one out here risking my neck.
Her and Luis are doing a drive down same as us.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. He looked over at me, trying to gauge my mood.
Do you like it so far?
It sure beats working for a living. He flashed a smile, eyes returning to the road.
Doesn't it?
We stopped briefly at Buddy's auto body shop across the street and 2 doors down from the apartment where Raymond lived. The garage itself sat in one corner of a property that extended from street to street. In the far corner, there was a corrugated metal shack surrounded by chassis, fenders, bumpers, engines, tires. A dilapidated chain-link fence enclosed maybe 2 full acres of wrecked cars and assorted parts. A sign read, Buddy's Auto Salvage, open 6 days, top dollar for your car or truck. One of the largest selections of used parts in Southern California. A big black Rottweiler, with a head as craggy as a tree stump, was asleep in the dirt beside a pickup truck. I said, Does Buddy work for you?
I'm Buddy. Guy runs the place's chopper. Back in a minute, he murmured as he got out.
Raymond apparently operated his repair business in conjunction with an auto wrecking and salvage company, probably dismantling vehicles once he'd maximized the insurance potential. I waited until he went into the garage, and then I got out myself and ambled over to the Pepsi machine just inside the door. I took my time tucking coins in the slot, extracting a can of Diet Pepsi. I popped the top and downed it, idly taking in my surroundings. There was not another soul in sight, and no indication of any work being done. The late afternoon sun slanted onto the cracked concrete floor in tawny yellow strips. The air smelled of oil, old tires, and hot metal. A pyramid of bright blue metal barrels had been laid on their sides and served now as storage bins for a jumble of rusted car parts. I could see Raymond through the open doorway of an area marked off as office space. The flat-roofed building appeared to be converted from a very small stucco house. Additional office space was provided by a single wide trailer tucked between the fence and the building. The horizontal panes of a pair of dusty louvered windows were slanted open to let in some air. A wooden pallet was leaning up against the trailer. There was an alarm company sign affixed to the side of the trailer, but I didn't take it seriously. This didn't look like an establishment famous for its security. Raymond finished his business and emerged from the garage with a guy at his side, whom he introduced as Chopper. He was an Anglo in his 40s, balding and squat. His breathing was labored and his face freckled with sweat. I said,
Great dog, hoping to ingratiate myself with his owner. That's Brutus.
Chopper gave a piercing whistle, and Brutus awoke obligingly and lumbered to his feet. The poor dog was ancient, so crippled by arthritis that he walked with a rocking motion, approaching by degrees. Up close, I could see his black hair was dusted with white. He paused beside me, his manner humble. I put my hand down near his nose, and he licked me. I felt embarrassingly dewy-eyed about the damn beast. Raymond and Chopper finished their business, and we walked on back to the apartment building, leaving the car where it was. Chapter 16 Bibiana was already home, seated at the kitchen table, applying a coat of bright red polish to her nails. She was wearing red shorts and a halter top in a vivid jungle print, red, black, olive green, and white. Her hair was pulled up in a glossy coil on top. Luis was out somewhere walking the dog. I marveled that Bibiana hadn't escaped while she could. Raymond had forgotten to return the telephone to its hiding place. He didn't seem aware of it, but Bibiana sure was. She ignored the instrument so studiously I had to guess she'd used it. I caught her eye with a visual query, but she kept her expression blank. I wondered who she'd called. Her mother? Jimmy Tate? Could he be out of jail yet? Raymond glanced at his watch.
Hey, it's nearly 5. Time to call your insurance agent.
My conversation with Mac was brief. Raymond let me handle the transaction without his ear pressed to the phone along with mine. I identified myself as Hannah Moore, and Darcy put me through to Mac, who spelled out the particulars of my insurance coverage, making sure the message would sound benign to anybody listening.
Mr. Dolan assured me you were covered in case of accident. Do you still have his number?
Yes, I've got it. Thanks for the information. I appreciate your help.
Anytime, he said. And keep safe.
I hope to. Once I'd hung up, I finished jotting down notes. Policy number, my deductible, liability, collision, major medical, and death benefits. I was assuming Mac had set up a special policy under the name Hannah Moore with a flag on the computer, so he'd be alerted if a claim came in. I gave Raymond the policy number and the data Mac had relayed. Shortly thereafter, I heard Perro tapping along the walkway outside, his breathing hoarse and wheezy as he strained against the leash. Luis opened the door, and the dog bounded in. Somewhere in a brain about the size of a BB, this beast had suddenly decided he remembered me. He charged at me joyfully, knocking into Bibiana as he vaulted across her lap. When he reached me, he jumped up, propping his paws on my shoulders so we could stare into each other's eyes. I leaned sideways against the kitchen table while he slopped a tongue across my mouth. Bibiana had leapt away from him with a shriek, her fingers held aloft so he wouldn't screw up her nails. Raymond snapped his fingers, but the dog was too intent on true love to obey. Raymond yelled something, which he covered with a cough. I caught a glimpse of his face just as his eyes began to roll back. A tick was tugging at his mouth, his lower lip pulling down grotesquely. His head jerked twice to the left, mouth coming open. His temper seemed to snap, and he went for the dog, landing an ill-aimed blow at Perro's meaty shoulder. The dog snarled and lunged. Raymond punched at the dog again, catching him in the nose. Perro yelped and scrambled away from him, cowering submissively. I moved into the path of Raymond's fist, blocking his next punch while Bibiana threw herself against him. Raymond shoved her out of the way. He knocked me aside and would have punched the dog again, but Luis hauled Perro by the choke chain and dragged him toward the door. Raymond stood and panted, eyelids fluttering, white slits visible along the rim. The rage and cruelty in his face were frightening, especially since his outburst was directed at the poor dog. Pit bull or no, Perro had a goofy innocence about him, and all of us felt protective. Bibiana pushed Raymond into a chair.
What's the matter with you?
Raymond rubbed at his fist, his self-control returning by degrees. Luis and the dog disappeared. My heart began to pump belatedly. Raymond was breathing hard. I saw his head jerk. He eased his right arm in its socket and did a neck roll to relax. The tension drained from the room. His gaze focused on Bibiana, who was pinning him to the chair, pressing down on his shoulders to prevent his getting up. She straddled his lap, the long, flawless legs anchoring him into place. It was the same move I'd seen her use with Tate the night before last. Hard to believe that less than 48 hours ago she'd been with him. Raymond stared up at her.
What's the matter? What's happening?
Nothing. Everything's fine, she said tersely. Luis took the dog for a walk. The moment passed. I was beginning to recognize the shifts in his moods. The spill of rage stirred sexuality. Before he could slide his hands up along her thighs, she removed herself from his lap as if she were getting off a horse. She smoothed her shorts and crossed to the television set, where she scooped up the deck of cards that was sitting on top.
"Let's play gin rummy," she said. "A nickel a point."
Raymond smiled, indulging her, probably thinking he would nail her later. When Louise came back with the dog, Bibiana lent me some jeans, a t-shirt, and some tennis so we could go out to dinner. The four of us left on foot and headed into the dismal commercial district that bordered the apartment complex. We crossed a vacant lot and went in through the rear entrance of a restaurant called El Pollo Norteño, which by my translation meant the North Chicken. The place was noisy, vinyl tile floor, the walls covered in panels of plastic laminate. The room felt close, nearly claustrophobic from the flame grills in the rear. Countless chickens were trussed on a rotating spit, brown and succulent, skins crisp and glistening with sputtering fat. The noise level was battering, mariachi music punctuated by a constant irregular banging of the cleavers, whacking whole chickens into quarters and halves. The menu was listed on a board behind the register. We ordered at the counter, picked up four beers, and then canvassed, looking for a booth. The place was crowded, patrons spilling out onto a makeshift wooden deck that was actually an improvement. It was quieter out there, and the chill California night air was a distinct relief. Moments later, a waitress appeared with our order on a tray, setting down paper plates and plastic flatware. We tore the chicken with our hands, piling shreds of grilled meat onto soft corn tortillas, spooning pinto beans and fresh salsa on top. It was a three-paper napkin extravaganza of messy hands and dripping chins. Afterward, we adjourned to a bar two doors away. It was nine by then. The Aztlan was smoky, cavernous, ill-lighted, occupied almost exclusively by Hispanic men whose eyes, at that hour, were turning slippery from all the alcohol they'd consumed. The laughter came in constant raucous bursts that were sly and assaultive, very worrisome. There was, on the surface, a thin veneer of control. Under it, and unpredictable, was the boiling violence of youth. The Spanish music was cranked up to a feverish pitch, forcing loud talk in aggressive tones that even merriment couldn't mask. I took my cue from Bibiana, who seemed watchful, her sexuality under wraps. Here there was none of the familiar bantering I'd seen in the meat locker. Raymond was too easily set off, and her intentions were too readily misunderstood. Louise seemed right at home, sauntering to the bar with his macho attitude. In his snowy white undershirt, his bare arms were a moving cartoon, Daffy Duck and Donald Duck in aggressive black and yellow. While Louise fetched four more beers, we pushed through the crowd toward the back. In a second room, about half the size of the first, there were three pool tables, two of them occupied. The felt surfaces looked as green as grassy islands under hot hanging lights. The dark of the ceiling was broken up by the blinking of multicolored Christmas tree lights that were probably strung up year-round. Raymond found an empty booth, and Bibiana slid in. I was bringing up the rear, sidetracked by the jostling of the intervening mob. I felt a hand on my arm, impeding my progress.
"Hey, babe, you play pool?"
I knew the voice. I turned, and it was Tate. I could feel my heart do a flip-flop, fearing Raymond's reaction. I glanced back at Bibiana automatically. She was squeezed into the booth, facing in my direction. She must have recognized Tate about the time I did, because her face seemed to pale.
"Let's just mosey over to the pool table," Tate said under his breath. "Has Raymond figured out yet it was me killed Chago?"
"If he did, you'd be a dead man. Donna got picked up before she could tell him everything. Why don't you get out while you can?" I murmured. Tate took my arm, moving me toward the pool table.
"Aren't you happy to see me?"
I closed my eyes briefly.
"Jesus, Tate, get away from me. What are you doing here?"
He took my hand. I was forced to follow as we crossed to the rack of pool cues, where I watched Tate select one.
"I had to see Bibiana. She tell you about us?"
"Of course. You could have told me yourself if you'd trusted me."
"Who had time? I's busy shooting bad guys."
He raised the cue to shoulder height and sighted down the length of it like a rifle.
Boom. How'd you know where we'd be?
Pick a cue stick, he said.
I chose one at random, too distracted to be particular. Not that I have a clue about the qualities of a good cue.
Not that one.
He handed me another cue stick and then continued casually,
This is Raymond's hangout. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out where he'll be. By the way, if Raymond comes over and wants to know what's going on, tell him the truth. We went to grade school together.
How'd you get out of the slammer? I thought you were broke. What's bail on a murder charge? $200,000?
$250,000. I got a friend in Montebello who put up his house. My attorney got bail knocked down to $100,000. I'm out on OR plus bail.
And they let you leave the county?
Quit worrying. It's legitimate. I talked my probation officer into an 8-hour turnaround. My wife's sick, I said. I'm due back in Santa Teresa by 6 a.m. or they'll throw me in the can again.
Tate arranged the balls in the rack and broke. Balls scattered everywhere with a satisfying crack.
What are we doing? I haven't played pool for years. 8-ball. It's your shot.
You're very cute, I said, without much conviction. Just tell me what to hit and let's get on with it.
You think I can have time alone with her?
No.
Would you give her a message? Would you tell her I'm doing everything I can to get her out of here?
Sure. We played pool. Jimmy Tate pretended to tutor me, and I took instruction, all in the interest of conducting a tense conversation overlaid with bright smiles. From a distance, I hoped we'd look like potential bedmates to someone who would kill us if he figured out what was actually happening. Tate loved it, of course. This was just the sort of situation he thrived on. Out there on the front line, taking flak, taking risks in the name of I don't even know what. I was feeling that same sick sensation that prefaces a tetanus shot. Something bad was going to happen, and I couldn't figure out how to escape it. Tate said,
You taking good care of her for me?
I'm a real champ, I said. This is the last time I'm ever doing shit like this for anyone. He smiled.
That's because you'd rather kick butt.
You got that right. Tate cleaned up the table and we joined the other three, who were bunched into the booth. Luis got up and I slid in beside Tate, who remained carefully attentive to me in the process. Luis found an empty chair and pulled it over to the table. I think it was the first time I ever served as a beard in a dangerous liaison. Liar that I am under ordinary circumstances, I found it a tricky business to fake a flirtation. I felt awkward and false, reactions not lost on Raymond, whose radar was telling him enemy aircraft was somewhere in the area. I felt his eyes scan my face with a half-formed question. Maybe he'd write me off as a hopeless social oaf. Certainly the woodenness of my response to Tate was obvious. Tate proceeded to tease me outrageously under Bibiana's watchful gaze. She was feigning indifference, but her interest was obvious. Aside from the fact the situation scared me silly, I was glad to have Tate on the scene. I hadn't realized before he showed up how isolated I was feeling. I was still vulnerable, of course, more so with him there. But at least I had a friend, and I knew from my long experience he'd lay down his life for me if it came to that. Bibiana, in range of Jimmy Tate again, began to do the ritual dance. There was nothing overt in her behavior. She went out of her way to cater to Raymond, tucking her arm in his, leaning against him so that her breast brushed his arm enticingly. She and Tate avoided eye contact, ignoring one another so pointedly I'd have thought them rude if I hadn't known their true relationship. As it was, the game they played was far riskier. The color crept up in her cheeks unbidden. I watched the sexuality emerge, some ancient, unspeakable response to her mate. I couldn't believe Raymond didn't pick up on it. The only clue I had about his inner state was the eruption of the tics, which were running once a minute. He was clearly feeling territorial. Whether he was sensitive to what was actually going on or not, Tate was still a male, not only on Raymond's turf, but in close proximity to his woman. Raymond seemed to swell, trying to engage Tate in a shoving match of boasts and braggadocio, a verbal pissing match. I don't know what among women would constitute an equivalent. I tuned out the talk because it was all chest-thumping bullshit, fueled by alcohol and testosterone. I couldn't even begin to compute what Tate's response might be when he found out Bibiana was sleeping with Raymond. The whole situation might have amused me if I hadn't been so eaten up with tension. Luis was watchful. The usual blank mask fell away, and I saw for the first time a wily intelligence at work. Behind his dead eyes, a lively animal lurked, all the more dangerous for its cunning at concealment. The spark died. He slouched in his seat, flinging an arm across the back of the chair. He lifted his beer bottle by the neck and drank deeply. By the time he looked at me again, the arrogance was back, the superiority of the male lording it over lesser mortals. I thought the night would never end. The Spanish music was jarring, either loud and frenetic or emotionally oppressive. The air was cloudy with smoke and the smell of beer. The only thing I cared about was staying very close to Tate, whose sun-weathered face was the only refuge I could see. I made him dance with me, in part to keep him away from Raymond, who was no fool. In the stress of the moment, we all drank way too much. I'd be sick in the morning, but I didn't care at this point. Maybe I could carve out a quiet life for myself on the bathroom floor, head hanging over the toilet bowl. We closed the place down at 2 a.m. Outside the bar, we parted company with Tate. I was just relieved to get out of the situation in one piece, with no fisticuffs, no confrontations, no tears. Luis left the three of us out in front of the apartment, peeling off in the Cadillac. I preceded Raymond and Bibiana up the stairs, waiting while Raymond unlocked the door and let us in. The dog lay in the doorway like a sentinel, lifting his heavy, bony head to give me a look as I passed. At least he had the good grace not to growl. I went into my room and slipped into my nightie, then headed for the bathroom. The door to the master bedroom was closed. I knew from the way Raymond had been looking at Bibiana that his desires were at a peak again. In the interest of keeping peace, she was going to have to submit. I felt for her. What could be worse than making love to someone you didn't want to be with, caught up in a situation that dictated intimacy? I washed my face and brushed my teeth, turned the bathroom light out, and padded barefoot into my room. I opened one of the windows and leaned out, gazing briefly along the street, first in one direction, then the other. No one was stirring. In the quiet of the hour, by the pale wash of moonlight, even poverty can look appealing. The shabbiness is cleansed, all the broken parts made whole. The concrete sidewalk seemed to glow with silver, the street a darker tone. A car passed, driven slowly. Jimmy Tate, perhaps? Was he wild with the notion of Bibiana in bed with someone else? I remembered Daniel, my second ex-husband, whose sexual betrayal had been a source of such anguish later. Later, after love dies, it's hard to remember how it could have ever mattered so much. From the other room I heard the muffled thumping as the king-size bed banged into the wall. I lifted my head, suddenly sobered by the realization that this was the perfect time to get some work done if I moved fast enough. I peeled off my nightie and pulled on some jeans. I yanked a T-shirt over my head and slipped my bare feet into Bibiana's tennis shoes, which I tied in haste. I unlocked the sliding glass window and shoved it open, aluminum frame rasping in its track. The night air was cold and a light breeze whipped across my face. Below, the passageway between buildings looked dark and empty. I could smell smog and briny ocean in a heady mix. I boosted myself up onto the windowsill and scrambled out onto the metal landing between flights of stairs. The alcohol I'd consumed was acting as a sedative for any anxiety I might have felt. My heart was pumping hard, and the effect was energizing. I was thrilled to be on the move again, excited to be looking at some action after all the enforced passivity.
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
Chapter 17. My tennis shoes made hardly any sound as I eased past Raymond's darkened window. I held my breath, but the closed bedroom drapes were still being flattened rhythmically as the headboard banged against them. I felt my way down the stairs, my footsteps making soft tinking sounds where my rubber soles touched the metal.
At the bottom of the steps, I paused to orient myself. I was sheltered in the dark shadow of the apartment complex. It was close to 3 a.m., the street deserted, the neighborhood cloaked in silence. Even traffic on the big boulevard half a block away was only intermittent. The moon was full and rode high in the night sky. The Los Angeles city lights projected an ashen reflection across the heavens, blotting out the stars. As my eyes became accustomed to the dark, I began to distinguish the clear, pale light being cast by the moon. I emerged from the gap between Raymond's building and the apartment complex next door. I turned left, clinging to the shadows as I crossed the street, moving toward the auto salvage yard. I touched the fence and felt my way along the perimeter, sometimes traversing the circular glow of streetlights. I chose a spot halfway down the block where a driveway cut through the fence. A cluster of tall weeds and ratty shrubs flanked the gate. By day, the dirt lane was used by the tow trucks bringing in disabled vehicles. At night, when the yard closed, a wide gate was rolled across the opening, looped with a chain and secured by a padlock. I pushed at the gate, forcing it open as far as the chain would permit. A 10-inch gap appeared. I hunkered, holding to the gatepost with both hands as I slid my right leg through. By pushing back with my hips, I could force the fence post back by another couple of inches. I rotated my shoulders, slipped my head through the gap, and then pivoted on my feet, neatly inserting myself into the yard on the other side. The chunky mountains of rusted metal were lightly frosted by moonlight. I felt as if I'd entered a charnel house of wrecked autos. Some cars had flipped, their tops squashed flat. Some had been torn in two on impact with trees, bridge abutments, and telephone poles. The roll call of destruction conjured up awesome images of the attendant human suffering. Ripped chrome and cracked glass, smashed fenders, splayed and flattened tires, engines rammed through hoods, steering columns crammed up against broken front seats. Every vehicle I saw represented a chapter in somebody's life, sometimes the last. Sirens and flashing lights signaling injury and death, the loss of a loved one, or the opening scene in a nightmare of mending and medical expenses. I waited until my heart had stopped pounding in my ears, and then I picked my way down the dirt lane toward the offices of Buddy's Auto Body Shop. The pickup truck I'd seen earlier was no longer parked near the trailer, but Brutus had been left behind to stand guard over the property. I could see him, black and bulky near the single wide, keeping watch as I approached. I sank down on my heels, calling to him softly, making little kissing sounds in the quiet. He gathered his hind feet under him, launched himself into a standing position, and began to toddle toward me carefully. He seemed to tiptoe, bones creaking, his forward motion fueled by memories of a vigorous youth. I held my hand out, and he sniffed it, making hoarse sounds of joy and recognition. I spent a few minutes with him, assuring him of my benign intentions. When I rose to my feet, he accompanied me to the trailer and watched politely while I removed all the louvers from the window. I stuck a hand through the opening and felt a solid wooden surface, which I guessed was a desk shoved up against the wall just below the window. I stacked the louvers neatly on the desktop inside. I hoisted myself up, whispering compliments to Brutus, who wagged his tail so hard he nearly toppled sideways in the process. "Back in a flash," I said. I swung my feet through the window and eased myself into the pitch black of the office. I was now sitting on a desk. I could feel an adding machine, the telephone, and miscellaneous office supplies. I replaced the glass louvers in the metal brackets made for them. I eased down off the desk. I stood there for a few minutes until I got used to the darkness. I usually don't do these breaking and entering gigs unless I have my little toolkit in tow. Flashlight and lockpicks, adhesive tape and jimmies. Here I was empty-handed, and I felt distinctly disadvantaged. All I wanted was to check the file cabinets to see if Raymond kept his papers on the premises. Once I established the whereabouts of the records, I was out of here. I was going to have to risk a light. I kept in mind the sign I'd seen, indicating an alarm system. Would Raymond actually have such a system, or was he the kind who thought he could deter all the burglars and vandals by pretending to have security?
Hard to say with him. He was so righteous about the law when it suited his purposes. I felt along the wall until I found the switch. I hesitated for a moment and then flipped the light on. The 40-watt bulb revealed an inner office, maybe 10 feet by 12, wall paneled halfway up with sheets of fake knotty pine. Girly calendars from the last 6 years were tacked up above a workbench, where some front windshields had been piled. 3 extension cords were plugged into a socket in the inner office and looped through the doorway to service the outer office. Every surface in the room was a jumble of cardboard boxes and greasy car parts. 2 gray metal file cabinets were tucked into the corner on the far side of the room. As I crossed the open door leading to the outer office, I caught a blink of light out of the corner of my eye. The passive infrared seeing eye of Raymond's alarm picked up my body heat and set off the entire system. A horn, probably adequate to announce the end of the world, began a great whooping noise that alternated between high notes and low notes, and seemed to include some kind of bell clanging in between. We are programmed from birth to react to sudden loud noises. Of course, I jumped and my heart kicked up into high gear. At the same time, I could feel my emotions disconnect, as they do in certain emergencies. I wondered belatedly if Raymond's alarm was set up to signal the police. I better count on it, I thought. I glanced at my watch. It was 3:12 a.m. I figured I had about 5 minutes max before the black and whites showed up. Might have been a charitable estimate on my part. Maybe the LAPD didn't even bother with alarms. Maybe they'd respond in their own sweet time. What did I know about the machinations of big city police procedure? While the alarm system bleated and shrieked and pointed an auditory finger, I crossed to the file cabinet and opened the first drawer. Invoices, car parts. I shut that one and tried the next. More invoices, financial records, correspondence, blank forms. Drawer 3 was a repeat. I skipped to the next file cabinet and started with the top, working my way down. The bottom 3 drawers were packed with manila folders full of claim forms. I glanced at dates in haste, noting that the claims seemed to extend back over 3 years. Outside, Brutus was offering up an occasional hoarse bark, apparently overjoyed that I had hit the jackpot. I closed the file drawers, checked to see that the louvered window was shut, tidied some papers on the desk, and brushed some dirt off the month at a glance that was lying there. I walked into the outer office, moved around the corner to the front door, which I opened, ducked back to the inner office, and flipped out the light there, then felt my way in the dark to the front door again. I stepped out and gave the door a hard pull behind me, effectively locking it again. The alarm clamoring against the night air seemed to have aroused no particular interest among the neighbors. I wondered if Raymond could hear it from across the street and 2 doors down. I set off at a run, jogging down the dirt path toward the gate, with Brutus bringing up the rear. I could hear him loping along behind me, panting happily as he maneuvered his legs in some dimly remembered sequence. I glanced back. For an old pooch, he was really truckin', determined to keep up with me in my little nighttime ramble. I reached the gate and pushed it, reversing the procedure by which I angled my way in. I heard a car squeal around the corner and looked back just in time to see the black and white appear on the scene. I shoved back hard on the fence post and pivoted my way through the narrow opening. I heard a sound like the equivalent of a canine rebuke. When I looked over, I saw that Brutus had his head stuck in the gap between the gate and the fence post. He was yanking backward, his bony head and the thick muscular neck pinched in a vise of fencing. Car doors slammed, and one uniformed cop headed toward the front entrance while the second one walked in my direction. "Oh, God," I said. I jerked the gate forward and pushed the dog's head to free him. Then I plunged into the bushes and crouched down. I was shielded temporarily by a tangle of shrubbery, but the oncoming cop was scanning every inch of the fence with a heavy-duty flashlight. Meanwhile, inside the fence, Brutus had discovered what I was doing. He put his nose against the chain link and made a worried sound, half growl, half celebration of our newly cemented friendship. The cop down the block near the office gave a whistle, and the officer closer to me turned and headed back the way he'd come. I pulled myself to my feet and extracted myself from the bushes, inching away from the squad car as inconspicuously as I could. Brutus began to bark,
unwilling to be abandoned just when the game was getting good. There was a line of parked cars at the curb. I reached the first and ducked behind it, using the cars as concealment until I reached the corner. I crossed the street at an angle and doubled back toward Raymond's, cutting into the heavy shadows between apartment buildings. Above me, the window in his bedroom blazed with light. I took the metal stairs three at a time, pulling myself up by the railing. Out of breath, I eased past the bedroom, found my open window, and plunged into the bedroom again. I whipped my shoes off, pulling my jeans down, and stuck my head out the door, squinting at the lights that were now flipped on in the hall. Bibiana, in a silk robe, was just emerging from the bedroom. I could hear Raymond in the living room on the phone with someone.
"What's happening?" I asked.
Bibiana rolled her eyes.
"It's the body shop. False alarm. Sometimes the damn thing goes off. Chopper's on his way over, but the cops say it's nothing. Go back to bed."
I closed the door. Sleep was a long time coming. I woke at 9:30 to the smell of coffee. I showered and dressed. The door to the master bedroom was open, and I caught a glimpse of the broad, king-size bed, neatly made. No sign of Raymond or Bibiana. I wandered into the living room to find that Luis was the only one on the premises, except the dog, of course. Luis paid no particular attention to me. He placed a clean mug on the counter, and I poured myself some coffee. "Thanks," I murmured. I sat down at the kitchen table, doing a quick inspection, first to make sure it had been wiped clean.
"Where's Bibiana?"
"They went off someplace."
"What are you, the babysitter?"
He made no reply. A carton of eggs sat open on the counter. In the day since I'd cleaned the kitchen, it had fallen into disarray again. Trash bags were lined up against the cabinets, bulging with beer bottles and discarded paper plates. The sink was piled high with dirty pots and pans, ashtrays spilling butts. Who smoked? I never saw anyone with a cigarette. Luis had pulled out the only clean skillet. He set it on a burner. He began to remove items from the refrigerator. Peppers, onions, chorizo.
"You want breakfast?"
"Sure, I'd love it. You need any help?" He shook his head. It seemed like the perfect opportunity to pump him for information, but I didn't want to start with the fraud ring itself, lest I seem too inquisitive. "I hope this doesn't seem too personal," I said. "I thought Raymond would be upset about Chago's death, but he hasn't said a word about it. Weren't they close?" Luis sliced the peppers into rings and then chopped onions, making no reference to the chemically induced tears rolling down his cheeks. His gaze came up to meet mine.
"Chago was all he had. Raymond's sisters kicked him out when he was 14 on account of his temper. He was on his own after that, and he's done okay.